fire rescue, EMS, law enforcement. These are the three components of public safety. And those who answer the call are the first responders. Welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders with your host, Steve Green. Five Alarm Task Force presents some of the best instructors and mentors in public safety today to educate, elucidate, and entertain. No topic is out of bounds, and every opinion has value. Five Alarm Task Force is pleased to welcome our new sponsor, Insight Fire Training LLC, your provider for the best fire service thermal imaging training, and our promotional partner, Dalmatian Productions, the Firehouse Tribune, and our new promotional partner, Chief Miller Products and Sites, Hennessy Distributing, your source for the cool towel, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, fighting to extinguish firefighter cancer since 2004, the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, and the 2018 Great Florida Fire School. Remember, our ultimate goal is for you to be safe and return home after every call. So insert those earphones or turn up those speakers. The 5 Alarm Task Force is being dispatched right now. New technology for the fire service seems to appear almost every day, and that technology demands a learning curve, especially if we're talking about thermal imaging cameras. That's where Insight Fire Training LLC is your best bet. With an excellent reputation across the U.S., Insight Fire Training will meet all your TIC training needs. Their curriculum is peer-reviewed and has been used internationally. Their instructors are Level 1 thermography certified, and they have taught in 33 states and 4 countries. Their courses run from introductory to training the trainers. Courses are available online, for the classroom, classroom hybrid, and even live fire. Insight Training LLC is proficient in over 40 thermal imaging cameras, so you feel confident they will know your make and model. Best of all, programs are customized to your specific needs, and their cadre of fire service veterans are vetted craftsmen of Project Kill the Flashover. They are so proficient that they have trained TIC manufacturers on how to best use and sell their own product. That's Insight Fire Training LLC. Look them up on InsightTrainingLLC.com. Your best bet for TIC training. Would you like to meet up with Andy and the team from Insight Training? Well, here's their upcoming schedule. December 9, 2018, Insight Training LLC will be hosting an 8-hour live fire training event in cooperation with York County Fire Department. Instructors Andy Starnes, Terrence Shoemate, and Thomas Anderson will lead this session. Please contact Training Officer Omar Casso for registration details at area code 305-281-2222 or via email at omar.casso, K-A-S-S-O, at yorkcountygov.com. February 6th through the 8th, Texas Association of Fire Educators with Sean Blumaker of Max Firebox. More details to follow. February 12th, 2019, Tactical Thermal Imaging, Enhancing Fireground Strategies and Tactics, sponsored by FD Tactics Training. Details to follow. February 28th, 2019, 6 p.m. to 10 p.m., Max Firebox Burn and Learn Thermal Imaging Training at Mount Pleasant Volunteer Fire Department in North Carolina with instructors Terrence Shoemate and Thomas Anderson. Details to follow. March 6th through 9th, 2019, Louisiana Instructors and Firefighters Training Conference. The registration opened November 1st. Brotherhood on the Bayou will host some amazing fire service leaders, Mike Dugan, Mark Von Appen, Sean Blumaker, and Andy of Max Firebox and KTF. Don't miss this one. We will be teaching 7 4-hour sessions from the 6th through the 9th. April 9th through 13th at FDIC 2019, a general conference presentation that will cover this often confusing and complex areas of thermal imaging from purchasing to policy. This is not a sales presentation. It is an educational program that is designed to assist firefighters in understanding the specifications of fire service thermal imaging camera and how that will affect their ability to perform on the fire ground. Insight Training LLC, your best bet for TIC training. We want to take a moment to tell you about one of our great promotional partners, the Firehouse Tribune. The Firehouse Tribune is an emergency services web-based platform where individuals can learn, train, and share ideas and experiences. In life, both on duty and off, we live by one creed. Excellence is a habit, not a goal. Interested? Find them on Twitter at FH Tribune and visit their website at www.thefirehousetribune.com. Remember to always work hard, stay safe, and live inspired.
Welcome to Chief Miller. Chief Miller operates the largest social media page dedicated to the men and women of the fire service from around the world. Check him out on Instagram at Chief_Miller. Find him on Twitter at Chief_Miller. And check out the website where you can find Chief Miller Apparel at ChiefMillerApparel.com.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Five Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. I'm your host, Steve Green. We hope you are all well and eager to listen to another excellent episode of our podcast. I'd like to remind you that you can find this podcast and our entire library of podcasts on our website at www.dalmatianproductions.tv, as well as on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and probably your favorite podcast streaming service. When you visit our homepage, please remember to sign up for our newsletter so you'll be the first to know about new episodes, new blog posts, or other Dalmatian news, including, by the way, our panel podcast that's coming up hopefully next month. If you listen to us via iTunes, please remember to rate us with 5 stars. That helps raise our ranking and assists others in finding us more quickly. And of course, please be sure to like us on Facebook at DalmatProd or at DalmatProdFire. If you'd like to share your interest and with the holidays coming up and about the podcast with families and friends, drop by our storefront with our friends from Teespring. Just head over to bit.ly/DalmatStore. Capital D on Dalmat, capital S's on store, one word, Dalmat Store, and choose from the t-shirts or mugs. And remember, most importantly, a portion of the net proceeds goes to the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. And I am pleased to welcome you tonight because we have a very special podcast. Yes, I am actually recording it at night. That tells you how special it is. And our guests are two, probably of the best, some of the best leaders that we have in the fire service today. Our guests are Deputy Chief P.J. Norwood, and Captain Sean Gray. So P.J. Norwood is Deputy Chief Training Officer for the East Haven, Connecticut Fire Department and has served 4 years with the Connecticut Army National Guard. He is an FDIC classroom, workshop, and HOT instructor, Fire Engineering Advisory Panel member, Fire Engineering book and video author of The Evolving Fireground, Researched Basic Tactics, which we'll be talking about later, and the Tactical Perspectives DVD series. PJ also serves on the UL-FSRI technical panel for the study of residential attic fire mitigation tactics and exterior fire spread hazards on firefighter safety. He is a public safety education group advisory member for UL-FSRI, and he has lectured across the United States as well as overseas. He is certified to the Instructor 2, Officer 3, Fire Marshal, and Paramedic levels. And Captain Sean Gray started his fire service career in Southern California in 1993 and currently holds the rank of fire captain with Cobb County Fire and Emergency Services in Metro Atlanta. He has a bachelor's degree in fire safety and engineering from the University of Cincinnati, my almost old alma mater for grad school. He is an FDIC HOT instructor and has been published in multiple fire service magazines. He serves on the UL Firefighter Safety Research Institute Advisory Board and is currently working on several firefighter safety research products. Sean has co-authored a book and DVD titled, as we said, The Evolving Fireground. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. It is an honor and privilege to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Steve. Really appreciate it.
Go ahead, PJ. Sorry.
We just stepped on each other there. Yeah, Steve, thank you very much for that great intro and the opportunity to chat with all your followers tonight in this podcast. Really looking forward to the conversation.
Well, as am I. As I said, Sean, that I did attend the graduate school, College Conservatory of Music,
at University of Cincinnati, but I was hired at a job, so I never wanted to finishing my master's degree. But I love the school. It's a great school and a wonderful city to be in.
Yeah, great place. Sure.
So I'd like to start the conversation this evening, gentlemen, with your book, The Evolving Fireground. I think that as we talked just off air before we started, that it was the title of the book that really drew me to both of you because of being what I call myself the dinosaur. I'm the old guy. I'm the guy who's been out for almost 40 years, but I remember the things that we used to do for the 8 years I was in until I got hurt. One of the things that my mentor told me then was that the fire ground is always changing. You can never fight a fire the same way that you did the day before because it probably won't be the same way it was, and we have to be ready to fight it the way it is. And I think that's what the title of your book is talking about. Plus, I like the undertitle, which is that the tactics that you talk about in the book are research-based. And they're not just opinions. And that's, I think, very important.
Well, you know, one thing about our book is PJ and I have both been writing articles for a long time on research-based tactics. And what got me or drew me to that, sent me to that direction, I should say, was a near miss of my own when I was a firefighter riding backwards and got into a situation that it was one of those fires that came out asking a lot of questions afterwards. And the officer, his reply to me once I started asking questions was, well, that's the way we've always done it.
Right.
And we always attack from the unburned side. And so that kind of wasn't good for me and a good enough answer. And so I started digging into research and trying to figure out why we did do it that way. And then really it turned off. It was just based on theories or opinions or best practices. And, you know, in today's age, we have so much more information with technology and data and research.
Sure.
That we really could make ourselves better by kind of utilizing that research. And so once we started writing a bunch of articles about that, it just kind of became the topic and things started rolling even more. And then with all the research out there, PJ and I felt like we needed somebody to bridge the gap in the American Fire Service. A lot of people see the UL and the UL Firefighter Safety Research Institute and the 900-page reports. And there's really not anybody that's there kind of deciphering that information.
Right.
and trying to apply it to the fire ground. And we had already written a bunch of articles about that. So we kind of felt like, hey, this might be something where we can make a difference. And so that's where the book comes in. It was a long process and took us a while to get done, but we finally made it. Right, PJ?
We did. It was a great experience. I learned a lot about myself, but also a lot about a lot of the topics. Because as Steve, as you mentioned, it's not just opinions. It's factual-based information from the research. So, you know, Sean and I would come to a topic, and we would have to research that topic and then try to figure out what the topic really meant and really dive into the data to make sure that we're putting accurate information out there. You know, it's a very different process than an article. You know, an article, you know, one or two pages, and, you know, somebody will read it once, and that's the end of it. It kind of goes away. Sean and I both knew that going into this book would be on a lot of shelves and a lot of desks and a lot of hands of recruit firefighters and experienced firefighters for years to come, and they're going to be referencing back to this. So we really spent a lot of time to make sure that the information was not opinion-based. Granted, there are some opinion-based information in there, of course, but the factual information is, in fact, based off of the data from the research.
Right. Let me, for the listeners, I'm just going to describe to you the book itself. It says, Deputy Chief PJ Norwood and Captain Sean Gray discuss how fireground strategy and tactics have evolved in light of fire research conducted around the world. They discuss the fire tetrahedron and how fuel, heat, and air all affect the fire's growth or extinguishment. Gray and Norwood take the lessons learned from the research as well as their general knowledge of the fireground to illustrate safer and more effective ways to operate on the fireground. They discuss how to apply this new understanding of fire behavior to two of the fire service's most important tasks, search and fire attack. This book is an important resource for anyone wanting to put new fire dynamics research to action. So a couple of topics are how firefighting activities affect the fire tetrahedron. We hear about that on on Twitter every day, don't we? Okay. To stay safe while working in the flow path on the fire ground. Well, that's something we do here on Twitter every day, the flow path arguments. Search methods that isolate the firefighter and victim. Very important. Fire attack methods that minimize the air fed to the fire. Just breaking ground now is coming out in public, in a large public volume, finally. And incident command size up and decision making. Again, very important. Matter of fact, the podcast I just released this morning with our good friend Captain Joe DeVito from Fort Myers is about size up and 360 for that first crew into a working scene. And so I think one of the things that I notice, and again, I'm talking about social media, and you guys are both on Twitter. You see it all the time. We see that one of the things really evil about social media is the anonymity, that people don't have to really say their real name. Fire junkie number six. And they're telling that, you know, you always go in that front door, you're always going to charge, you're always going to do this, you're always going to do that. And then if you disagree with them and try to offer a counter opinion, not, I mean, even politely, that's it. For the next 10 days, you get nothing but crap from them on your Twitter DM. Yet you went ahead and not only did you do the book, but you also brought a DVD series along with it. And I think that's something different that, yes, a lot of the companies, the publishers have made DVD sets, but I can't remember the last time a book like this, a real good teaching book, has come out with a DVD as a partner to it. What brought you to that level?
Man, I think, let me touch on the social media thing first.
Sure.
So I'll just tell a quick story of a situation that actually happened today. So one of my firefighters graduated from the Georgia Smoke Diver Program today. And he completed it. And him and I were texting yesterday, and he said, hey, there's a guy here at Georgia Smoke Diver from out of state, and he says he knows you. And I was like, oh, really? What's his name? And he said, oh, well, he says he argues with you on Twitter. And so I kind of laughed, and I said, well, I don't recognize his name, but you mentioned the anonymity, and that very much so. I don't even know what his username was, but he's a guy that he's a younger firefighter, and obviously engaged in the fire service, but it's somebody who's hiding behind one of those usernames. And that's one thing I think you won't see BJ and I do. If we are using our tag name of Stop Believing, Start Knowing, typically if one of us is tweeting under that, you're going to see a sign, Sean or BJ.
Right.
We're going to be under our own Twitter names that is, you know, Sean Gray and BJ Norwood. So here's our names. You know who we are. And it's, you know, it is, of course, there's some opinions there, but most of the time when we start to get into arguments, we just try to show them the facts, guide them to the report. You know, if somebody's asking questions about fire attack, for example, that seems to be the hot topic. Hey, here's the report. Here's the link to it. Go read it for yourself. You know, this is where I got my information from, and try to guide them to that. So, but social media is a difficult animal and can be frustrating at times, but I don't think people would even know who we are or have any idea what we've done without social media. So it's also very powerful.
Absolutely. That's how I found you, the two of you, and followed you for a while. And then I think it was almost a year ago, PJ, I started sending you, you know, some, you followed me, thankfully. And I sent you a couple of direct messages to invite you to the podcast because I read what you had been writing. And I saw a lot of value to it, and it made a lot of sense. And it wasn't diatribe, and it wasn't trying to force your idea down somebody's throat. It was just trying to educate and elucidate. You know, that's what we put in this intro to this podcast, is that it's for education and elucidation, to make things clearer to firefighters, to understand why we do what we do, even if we don't innately feel that that's the way we want to do it. There's a reason why sometimes we have to do it in a certain way. And I think that's what your book is going to bring out to everybody.
So, Steve, we do appreciate that. And I want to hit on the social media stuff as well. And then we could touch on the DVD, because that's kind of a funny story that we know that you'll appreciate how that came to. But, you know, and the thing about social media, it is a necessary evil of the fire service today. And it does have a lot of value. But on top of, like, the anonymity piece that, you know, Sean was mentioning, that is frustrating for everyone, because we do put ourselves out there. And we do spend a lot of time. But the one piece that it appears does not relate very well, or it's related, translated not so well over social media, is, you know, when Sean and I speak in classrooms, it comes across a lot smoother, a lot better, because they can hear the whole context. There's no character limit.
Sure.
Well, we don't, you know, at no point do Sean or I, under our personal names or under Stop Leaving, Start Knowing, ever try to tell anyone how to fight their fires. Because quite frankly, Sean or I can't tell any department or any agency or any firefighter or any officer how to fight their fires, because we all show up with a little different resources, different crew staffing, you know, the built-up environment may be a little bit different. Right? So what we do is provide information. So the firefighters reading, watching, discussing, arguing, debating, can take that information and figure out what's going to work for them. You know, we're kind of labeled as the hit it hard from the yard guys. That every fire we go to, we want to spray water in the windows. And that's the furthest thing from the truth. The last couple fires I've been to, we haven't used transitional tack. You know, and Sean could talk about his recent fires. You know, it's an action of opportunity when the situation is right, and it's not for every fire. So if we can help get that message out to this podcast, you know, that's not character limited. It's not, that's not what we're about. We are about utilizing fast water. And when we start talking tactics a little later in the show, we'll get more into fast water and what the true goal of the fire ground should be with fire tech. But it's not for every situation or every fire. So I want to make sure I got that out from the beginning. And then to kind of backtrack a little bit on the DVD, the DVDs actually came out prior to the book, because it was a lot quicker process. But fire engineering books and videos brought Sean and I out to Tulsa Fire. And we had an opportunity to spend a couple days with an amazing group of firefighters and officers at the Tulsa Fire and their training academy. And we really didn't know that we were going out to do a DVD, to be honest with you. We thought we were going out for a couple days and we were going to teach some hands-on classes and pieces and parts that were going to be filmed and utilized for a DVD. But when we got there, we were told, hey, we have a classroom set up for you. And we're good to go. We have a couple of shifts of Tulsa firefighters coming down. And you guys are going to spend some time in the classroom today. And then we're going to go outside and do everything that you just talked about in the classroom. We're going to film it all. Well, Sean and I kind of looked at each other. We didn't have a laptop. We didn't have a PowerPoint. We didn't have a class built, because we just thought we're going to go out to the training ground and we're just going to teach. We're going to, you know, show how to do different things.
Right.
So we're kind of, you know, I'm the guy that needs to have everything kind of planned, the military and me, you know. And Sean's like, well, no, we got it. And he goes to Mark Hall. He goes, Mark, we got a whiteboard? Mark goes, yeah, we got a whiteboard. So Sean grabbed the marker, went up to the whiteboard, made some categories. He goes, okay, this is what we're going to talk about. And we looked at each other, said, well, we got nothing to lose. And we stood up at that whiteboard, as you can see in the DVD, and we just talked. It was the first time that I've ever done a class like that, and I was a nervous wreck going into it. But to this day, it's probably one of the best classes that we've ever taught together. There was no script. There was no PowerPoint slides. There was no video. There was no, well, we'll talk about that after. Whatever came to our head based on the topics that Sean put on the board, and it turned out really, really well. I was quite impressed that we were able to pull it off. And in fact, that's what we do now at FDIC for our evolving fire ground, our two-hour classroom, is we took that whiteboard and put it into five or six different PowerPoint slides, and we just stand up in front of the FDIC crowd and we just talk about the topics with no slides, no PowerPoint, no death by PowerPoint.
That's great. That really
is. Conversation. Yeah, so it's a lot of fun, and it's pretty cool how that DVD came about and how it's really helped mold me to be a better instructor. I don't need PowerPoint slides to fall back on.
Right.
We can just get up there and have a like sitting around the kitchen table in the firehouse, or like in this podcast tonight, and about random topics that we all want to hear about.
That's great. It really is. And just to drop back for one moment, then I'm going to turn it over to you guys, is that, as I mentioned before we started, that I'm originally from the Boston area, so my Boston Jakes, my Massachusetts Jakes, my New England Jakes are very near and dear to me. And this past early spring, I had the unique opportunity to interview the deputy chief, who turned out to be of my hometown, Framingham, Mass., which is now a home city because they grew, Chief Kevin Burns. It was right during the height of the really loud debate on Twitter between transitional and interior attack. I asked him what his feeling was, because I knew the buildings he was talking about, because it was my town. That's where I grew up. We were only a few years apart in age, and we knew the same places that we all hung out as kids in the high school and stuff like that. So I knew exactly what he was talking about. And he says, Steve, the argument to me boils down to two words. It depends. He says, I can't tell you that I would hit every fire this way or that way. I could go to 13 Smith Street and say, no, we're going to hit it from the outside first. No, we're going to go in because that's what I see. I made my 360. I looked around. This is the situation. But I can come back 24 hours later to 15 Smith Street, and we got a fire that looks the same, but I'm sending my guys in. Knock it down with a hose. Get in there, guys, and do it. He says, everything means it depends. That's all you can say about it. And so knowing you're from, outside of, you're part of Connecticut, you're part of that Jake family, and I appreciate that candor.
Well, I appreciate you bringing up the good chief, because I actually have a pretty good relationship with him, and it the bigger relationship stems around the New York Yankee versus Boston Red Sox rivalry that the two of us have.
Yeah, he and I were pretty lucky this year, weren't we?
I would say lucky. So we chatted back and forth a little bit on Twitter, and he would send a couple questions to Sean and I every once in a while. And then Sean and I were up in Cape Cod about a year and a half ago now, or last winter maybe, I forget when it actually was. And he says, hey, I see you're going to be up in the Cape. Could you contact the host department and see if I could come to the class? And I was kind of, blown away that, here's a chief from a decent-sized city who's been around the block more than once. And he's interested in coming to a research-based tactic class. And Sean and I, open arms, absolutely, please come. And he came to the class, and he was engaged. He was asking questions. We've chatted more after that. And it was really, really motivating, I guess you could say, because, a lot of times we'll get the chief officers that have been in the fire service as long as he has been. And this is the way I've been doing it for 30 years. I'm not changing. Right. But he's one of the exceptions to the rule where he's completely open-minded and knows that the fire ground has changed and that we need to keep changing with the fire ground so we keep our brothers and sisters safe.
Exactly. And I was amazed at the same thing. And then I had this pride swelling in my heart that this was the guy, even though I had moved out, but this was the guy at some point was protecting my town. And it meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to have the opportunity to get back up to Boston and actually have some time to spend with them. All right, so I think what we're going to do here, guys, is we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, I'm going to turn it over to the two of you. Let's talk about the topics that you feel are, pardon the pun, but the hot topics that we want to discuss tonight and get some information out to our listeners. We have listeners, thank goodness, in over 60 countries across 6 out of the 7 continents, and I've even made an inquiry into McMurdo Fire Department down in Antarctica. I'm waiting to hear back from them. But we'll see what happens with that. But I think we know that we have firefighters who listen to our podcast every week or twice a week, and they're anxious to hear some great stuff that you guys are going to provide for them. So, folks, we're going to be right back with our guest, PJ Norwood and Sean Gray, right after these words. So please stay tuned. No matter where we live or no matter the season, there is always work to be done that makes us sweat. Just how can we keep cool? Well, Hennessy Distributing has the answer. Cool towels. Cool towels are 100% cotton towel and pre-moistened with all natural ingredients. The best part? No water is needed. Just open your cool towel pack, remove the towel and give it a couple of shakes, and you're all set. Wrap it around your neck like a kerchief. Wipe your face, arms, neck, or any exposed skin, and it is approximately 20 to 30 degrees below the ambient temperature. Wait, did it warm up? No problem. Just shake it a couple of times again, and Cool Towel delivers its refreshing cool touch all over again. When the cooling mixture has expired, use your Cool Towel as you would any cloth or rag around the house. Because it is manufactured from 100% cotton, your Cool Towel is 100% recyclable. For more information or to get your cool towel today, visit www.cooltowel.com or call 1-800-918-8323. Remember, you're going to work and you're going to sweat. Make Cool Towel your answer to keeping cool.
The tone sound and the dispatcher announces, stations 14 and 16, working residential structure. That was all you needed to hear. You jump up from your chair. head to the engine and climb into the jump seat. As the cue screams, you take stock of your PPE. Bunker pants, check. Turnout coat, check. Hood, check. Gloves, check. Escape line, check. SCBA strapped on, you're ready. Upon arrival, you jump off the apparatus, grab the loops of the red crosslay, and head for the open front door where smoke is pouring out. You make sure your buddy's behind you. You crouch low and make your way inside, your trusty SCBA mask hanging on your tool belt. What? Stop everything. What the hell are you thinking? You see it's a working room and contents fire, and the smoke is banking down almost to the floor. Who do you think you are, Superman? One breath of that crap and the smoke will damage you in some way, guaranteed. All the soot, carbon, carcinogens, and other outgassing materials will enter your body through the pores on your unprotected face. Don't be the domino, the first person down that forces everyone else to change their tasks to take care of you. Always remember, face peace on. You have comrades depending on you and a family to go home to. Face peace on. Remember when you were a young boy or girl and someone bullied you or teased you? Where did you most often turn to? Like many of us, you turned to your family. If you're a first responder, you probably no longer worry about those childhood problems. But there are plenty more that can affect us. Lack of sleep, the tragedy and horror we often see, even life's everyday stumbling blocks like family illness, money, and job problems, and more. So where do we turn now? Your gut reaction might be to keep it to yourself and not tell anyone about the hell you're going through. However, that's not going to help you or anyone else. Instead, you could start with your second family, someone you work with at the firehouse, on the ambulance, or at the station house. You spend a lot of time with them, don't you? And most of them understand many of the problems you're dealing with. Reach out to a coworker or an officer you trust. Speak to clergy of your house of worship. But don't keep it inside, gnawing away at you. That's not good for you or anyone around you. Know that there are people who stand ready to listen to you and help you without passing judgment. Remember, to carry out your oath to protect life and property, the first life you have to care for is your own. This message is brought to you by this podcaster. He's been there and done it. Welcome back to this special episode of Five Alum Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. I'm Steve Green, your host, and with joining me this evening are two of the, probably the biggest names in fire instruction and teaching today, and that's PJ Norwood and Sean Gray. And we're talking about parts from their book, The Evolving Fireground. Sean, I'm going to address this to you first. Let's talk about the debate and your thoughts about transitional attack.
Okay. So, you know, first of all, because I talk about transitional attack a bunch, and that was my first class at FDIC. It was based off attacking from the burn side. And so, of course, on social media, I'm the guy that wants to hit it from outside on every fire. And, all the nicknames and everything else. But I think one of the things about that's important that why I was so passionate about transitional attack is that there have been so many fears over the years of transitional attack. I can remember back to being a firefighter on the nozzle and wanting to put water in a window that fire was blowing out of. And I could, you know, the fire's venting out a window and getting up into the attic. And I'm like, no, I don't want it to get into the attic. I'm trying to keep it from the attic, but I'm just like sweeping this, you know, the just above the window.
Sure.
And then the stream accidentally goes into the window. And I'm like, oh God, hopefully my officer doesn't get mad at me and kick me in the butt. Right. And, so then when I learned from research that, hey, actually that's a good thing. That's when I started educating people on that. And then really, man, just the pushback against it. And, I think the biggest thing that bothers me about the pushback against it is that it almost comes down to ego. It really comes down to ego. There's people out there that are just, I'm absolutely never going to do that. I'm never going to put water on the fire from the outside. And that is why I think I get so passionate about the topic, is because I don't understand why you wouldn't. And we're not telling you to stand on the outside forever. We're telling you to knock down the fire, a quick hit that makes everything better for those inside. for us when we go outside. There, I mean, it just, it's something that is, has so much data to back it up, and it just boggles my mind to wonder why somebody would say, I'll never do that, when it could be right there in front of your face. So one of the things I like to use is that we were always taught on an interior attack to never go past a room that's on fire.
Right.
And so why would you go past a window with venting fire on the outside if you have a charged hose line in your hand? And you start to put that, frame that and put that in your head, and people go, oh, well, I don't really know why. And it just comes down to, well, because of social media and hit it hard from the yard and squirting from the dirt and skeeting from the street and all those nicknames that it has, is that all these people just think that, well, you're way tougher if you go inside the front door. But it's hard for me to understand why, if I stand 1 foot outside the threshold of the door and flow water from the outside to the inside, that's not cool. But if I take 2 feet forward and go inside that threshold, I'm now salty and tough. And I'm just like, that's ridiculous. Like, well, just come on, let's be better. And, you know, I mean, there's a million different options that are out there. Staffing, not for every fire. But, you know, I've been and taught to in rural places like Minnesota. And guys out there in Minnesota, mostly volunteer, and they're all looking at me like, well, we have to do this on every single fire. This isn't cutting edge. And then I'm like, well, in my department, you know, 700 members and in a Metro Atlanta agency, all career, it's a big topic. It's a big argument. So, you know, that's my biggest thing, is use it to your advantage. It's not for every fire. I certainly don't do it on every fire. It happens probably maybe 20% of the time on our fires, but my department has embraced it. It's not something that, if we don't call it transitional attack. We call it a quick hit. Hey, mm-hmm. Give it a quick hit.
Right.
But that transitional attack term, for whatever, has got mud all over it. And people just love to beat it up on social media, especially. So I just wish people could understand that, you know, my thing is, I want you to use it to your advantage. Use transitional attack to your advantage to make things better for not only you and the people that you're with, but also for the possible victims that are trapped inside.
Absolutely.
Use the research to your advantage. You know, that's my spiel on transitional attack.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the dirty three-letter word, ego, because I just taught two weeks ago at the Great Florida Fire School. It was the first time I've taught in a fire school in 30 years. My class was the elephant in the firehouse, when ego gets in the way of passion. A lot of it dealt with the concept of what happens with ego, and a concept I brought up, developed last March or so, about the first domino. Why ego drives somebody that they always have to be the first one through the door, even if they know that physically or based on their medical problems, they know they shouldn't be, but it's that ego that drives them. And then, of course, they go through the door and they fall over and keel over, and they're the first domino, and it changes the picture of the entire fire ground. And I think, listen, as I didn't say anything on the Twitter debate going back and forth, but as you explained it, and now thinking back to as I was reading it, I think a lot of it from the people I saw pushing that you have to go through the door every time, I think it you were exactly correct. It's a matter of ego. And it's a matter of, that's the way we always did it, and so that's the way we're going to do it. You can't force somebody.
Yeah.
And as you said very succinctly, you only do it 20% of the time. But when it's right, you do it.
Yep, no, that's exactly it. And you know, one of the things is that the hit that everybody wants to take, you're delaying get to the interior. You're delaying getting to the victim.
And right.
I wish we could. I wish time was somewhere that we could actually include that. But in the research, it's impossible to do because there's too many variables. You know, the setback, the skill level of the crew. There's so many variables for the fire ground that there's no way to measure it. But that time to victim is really what we're looking at, right?
Right.
And I think I could argue, by using an exterior stream to knock down the fire and take away that flashover, it's going to be much faster for you to go in and find that person down the hallway, because you don't got to crawl down the hallway and do a clamp slide and pull a bunch of water and do all this stuff because we're fighting back the dragon.
Sure.
When fire's already knocked down, now I can walk right down the hallway and the temperatures aren't even elevated. So, and that's where I'm coming from on that stuff. But people just, and are very resistant to it. So, but I haven't given up. I'll continue to beat the drum.
Well, don't, because I think if just a couple of weeks ago, I'm sure everyone's mutual friend, Chief Billy Goldfeder, had a brief video on that he put out on Twitter showing a working house fire, and they used the gun on top, made a quick hit. It cooled the whole house down. They made entry, and they made a good recovery. And that's why he pushed it, because it was, for that particular instance, it was the smart thing to do. They used that deck gun. They hit it hard, fast. They cut it off. They went in with a line, and they made a good recovery. And that's what that's what we're after.
No, that's exactly that. And I think that's what PJR and I both are about, is trying to just be smart. Be a smart firefighter. That's what we want. That's why we're trying to educate you. Use the research to your advantage to be smarter, more efficient, and more aggressive on the fire.
All right. That's great. Thank you very much for that. All right, PJ, we're going to turn to you. And since we're talking about what kind of attacks to use, that's going to depend a lot on the fire behavior, correct?
Correct. You know, along with being the two firefighters that only want to, you know, squirt water in the windows, we're also known as the firefighters who only know how to fight fires in dollhouses, you know. And a lot of the classes that we teach is focused around the fire dynamics and the fire behavior. You know, and this started with Sean. Sean was got this information from Chief Ed Harton out in Whibley Island in Washington State on this fire behavior box. And he asked me to come down to the Metro Atlanta Firefighter Conference with him and teach a class, and we're going to do this fire dynamics demonstration. And it went great, and we had a lot of fun, but it had some limitations. And I had a department in Connecticut who said, "Hey, PJ, I want you to come teach that class, and I want to burn one of those boxes." As I told Captain Palmer from Stamford, Connecticut, I says, "You know, Cap, that sounds great. Here's the plans. You build the box, I'll come burn it." Well, about a month later, he sent me pictures of what we now know as the Palmer's box, which is the dollhouse that we've burned in, I don't even know how many states Sean and I have burned it in. We've hit 20, 30 countries. We've hit all 50 states with the plans for the box. And if you go to YouTube and you put in dollhouse, there's just thousands of videos now, because Sean had this idea from Ed Harton, and we turned it over to Matt Palmer, Captain Palmer, Stamford, Connecticut, who redesigned the box to look like a house.
That's great.
And we've had great results with it. What it comes down to is, when we all entered the fire service, we were taught about the fire tetrahedron, right?
Right.
Went through the pieces of the fire tetrahedron, and we paid attention to the instructor when he or she stamped his or her foot in the ground, so we make sure we got the test questions right. And that was it. We moved on. We went to hose streams. We went to ventilation. We went to forcible entry. We went to all these other fire ground tasks. And we never correlated it back to the fire tetrahedron. But yet, everything we do in the fire grounds directly impacts the fire tetrahedron, positively and negatively.
Right.
And unless we truly understand that, we can't be completely efficient on the fire grounds. Right? If we don't know that when we force the door, if we don't start flowing water, what could happen based on the fire behavior? How are we going to be successful? So some people want to, you know, say that, well, we can't, you know, have you do the dollhouse because we're a big city department, and, you know, we have H-type buildings, and we have the, you know, high-rise buildings. So the dollhouse is a private dwelling, and that's very far from the truth. The dollhouse is to teach and to show how fire reacts to the fire tetrahedron by controlling the air or providing too much air, changing the fuel package. So it's strictly a fire dynamics lesson that we can then relate to any building in any country in the world, because the fire is going to react the same way, right? Fire is physics. It needs certain elements to react in certain ways, regardless if it's in an H building, whether it's in a private dwelling in Connecticut, whether it's in a private dwelling in Antarctica. It's going to react the same way based on the elements that are available of the heat, fuel, and the oxygen.
Sure.
So that's what we show, and we've had some great results, and it's pretty cool. Sean and I teach these classes, and we've gone into some contentious classrooms, you know, and you get the group of firefighters sitting way out back with their arms crossed, slouched down in the chair, you know, just giving you that death stare. And then we start talking, and we get 20, 30 minutes into the class, and now they're sitting up straight. Arms are still crossed, but they're sitting up. And 45 minutes, 60 minutes, now their arms are uncrossed. They're kind of leaning forward. And you can really tell that now they're listening, right? and that's all we ask. Just come and listen to us. You don't have to agree with us, but come and listen. And then, you know, the classroom portion gets over, and then we move outside. And we do the small-scale fire behavior demonstration, and those are the firefighters that come up to us after and hang out after the class and are talking to us, asking us questions, telling us about fires that they've had in their career where the exact same thing happened, but they didn't realize what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
So the fire dynamics piece and the fire behavior piece is very, very intriguing and interesting to me, because I've been in the fire service since 1988, and I've learned more about fire behavior in the last 5 years from a dollhouse than I did at any fire ground that I've ever been on.
Wow.
So it's a lot of fun, and it's great when you could take firefighters that have been doing this either 1 year or 30 years and teach them the most basic part of our job. You know, one of the questions we ask, and we stole this from Captain John Cirillo, who we teach with, he holds up a candle and asks everybody in the room, what's the hottest part of the flame? And he points to three parts on the candle. And do you know that that is the most basic piece of the fire grounds? And not just nobody, but the class is always split three ways.
Really?
Nobody knows the hottest part of the flame. And that's the most basic piece of what we're dealing
with. It's the blue part, right, PJ? Hey, PJ,
it's the blue part, because we always know blue is hot, right? So that's, you know.
Yeah.
And that's it's mind-boggling the first time Captain Cirillo did that. I'm like, well, that's a flame. We all know about flames. So, of course, every firefighter in here is going to know. And in actuality, the majority don't know. So it's a lot of fun. And the fire dynamics piece is a great educational piece that we can't learn enough about, because it definitely impacts everything that we do on the fire ground.
Well, you know, being a lifelong teacher, if you can engage your class, engage your students, and give them something that they don't expect, then that's the hook. You know, you're dangling that hook in front of that big old bass. And when you can do it that way, as opposed to just trying to tell them something, and you're making them feedback and guess where they think they know everything, and then you're able to, again, educate them, then usually that class is going to become successful, and you're going to have the results that you said. They come up after the class and talking with you and sharing anecdotes about fires and stuff like that. And that's probably the best way that any teacher, no matter you're teaching fire science, you're teaching math in a school, you're teaching biology out in the woods, you engage your students and show them that you're not forcing them to learn something, you're engaging them that they want to absorb and learn what you're giving them. You know, over the years, you guys have seen it much more recently, but I'm sure you've seen the like a sine wave of the new recruits who come in from your own time when you guys were the probies and came in and had to go up, you know, go up the stairs. But you've seen that sine wave of people who are receptive to the education, some who have that, you know, arms across the chest and sitting back with their legs, you know, shot forward and back and forth. I'm not sure where we are now. I think a lot of people are shutting down the new generation too quickly. I don't believe they're giving them enough credit or chance to excel and be good. I hope that they will. But I know as I watch the generation after my children coming up, that these kids have never lived without cell phones or without digital video games. But already, a lot of them are flying the drones that protect this country because of their eye-hand coordination. And so hopefully, as the fire service grasps more and more technology in it with drones, the new 3D technology, FirstNet, things like that, we're going to see some of these younger recruits coming in and showing their skills by blending their skills with what you folks can teach them and, again, creating a better fire department that protects, that does our job. We do our job for one reason, to protect the lives and property in our communities that we protect. And that's the most important thing. That's the goal.
Well said.
Thank you. All right. Yeah, we'll go a little more in this segment. Who would like to talk about the flow path? Which one of you would like to handle that one? Stay safe while working in the flow path.
I think we both can. If you want to start off with Sean, and then I can pick up where he leaves off, and get a little bit from each of us.
Sounds good, Sean. If you will, please.
Yeah. So, you know, flow paths. And people are like, oh, well, flow paths aren't new. And James Braid talked about them in the mid-1800s. And you're absolutely right. They're not new. They have been there since we started learning about fire. And James Braidwood was somebody who did document that in the mid-1800s. And he called them air tracks. But really, flow path comes from Dan Majerkowski at UL. And, you know, he started thinking about a way to describe them better. Nobody really understood what an air track was, or and I certainly didn't know what a flow path was when I went through the through school. So, but now we have, you know, a bidirectional flow path or a unidirectional flow path, and really important to understand the difference between those. But we just had a commercial building fire 10 days ago, and you know, going back and looking at some of the bystander video that was there, our fire attack was going into a unidirectional flow path. And fortunately, my chief recognized that and, you know, was able to get them to back out. And that's huge in understanding fire behavior on the fire ground. He realized that they were going in the chimney, and let's fix this and let's attack this from a different direction. We don't always have to go through the front door. And so recognizing that was a huge, huge piece, because we had some inexperienced guys that were on that initial hose line going in the front door. And I, you know, that's where flow path comes in. I think it's so important. It's just that simple piece of recognizing it on the fire ground, mm-hmm. whether if you're in a command situation and going, okay, hey, that doesn't look right. Let's fix that. And then as far as working in the flow path, we have to work in a flow path. You know, a bidirectional flow path, when you see that exchange of air, the clear air tunneling down below and the smoke coming out of the top, you now know this, the fire's on the same floor as you, essentially. Hey, I know where the fire is. You can, even if you get down low and look below it and follow that air track, that movement going in, you might be able to see the fire or see where it's starting to mix at the floor and get a good idea of where the fire location is just by looking at the front door to do that. So we have to work in the flow path. So how do we handle flow paths? Well, one, we recognize them. That's the most important thing, is recognize what kind of flow path we have, because we can kind of determine the fire location by recognizing what flow path we have. And then two, what do we do to somewhat slow down that flow path so it doesn't hurt us or hurt the people that are inside the building? And that's controlling the air that causes the flow path. So we use door control to do that. And then at the same time, once we're in the flow path, recognizing, hey, I'm in the flow path, we need to flow some water. Things are getting hot over top of our heads. And that's the biggest piece of working in the actual flow path, is just knowing that you're in it. We're not saying not to go in flow paths. We're saying that flow paths can absolutely kill you. And that's what kills citizens as well, because they're in unprotected areas. But recognizing that you're in a flow path and then doing something about it.
Okay, great. PJ?
So, you know, flow path, like Sean said, something that we've always known about. And I think, you know, many of us have great lessons of, you know, reading the smoke. And Dave Dotson and now Phil Jose did a great job at teaching that, you know, the art of reading smoke. But it takes it a little bit further to really identify what's going on in the fire ground. And the piece of the flow path, like Sean just talked about, you know, at the door, we've seen that. We understand that. We can comprehend that, you know, very well.
Mm-hmm.
But now you take that to our tactics and you correlate flow path with vertical ventilation. You know I was always taught that vertical ventilation equals cooling. All right, you have a house that's choked with smoke, get to the roof, cut the hole, pop the top, you get that lift, the building cools down, the engine company can get in better, you know, to put water on the fire, the rescuer, the truck, you get in to do the search quicker. But the piece that we didn't realize is that when we're opening up the roof and we cut that hole in the roof, yeah, we are getting that lift, but we're creating a flow path from that front door, from the window that's failed, from the window that's open. And it's actually not equaling cooling. But for many, many years, all of us were crawling down that hallway. The roof gets opened, and now we felt that it got cooler because we were in the flow path.
Right.
Right? That fresh air, that cool air was coming in from the outside and going up and out the top. Yes, it was giving us that lift that we've all been taught. We've seen that. We felt that cooling effect. But in reality, that flow path is fresh air that's feeding that oxygen, and actually temperatures are rising. But because of that that flow path and being in that fresh air inlet, we actually felt like it was actually cooling the environment. So while we have always known flow paths have been there, while we always understood air tracks because we have been able to see it, I don't think we have had a good comprehension of what was truly happening. But because of the research, because of the data, we can understand that, yes, vertical ventilation does, you know, give you that lift, but it's not giving you that cooling. So we're actually working or putting our companies in that flow path and giving them a false sense of security.
Okay, I think that's important information and great information for our firefighters to know and hear, because what you said was the way I used to fight fire. That's the way I was taught, just to go with it. And whatever happened, and to, you know, pop the top, as you said, we thought that was always the best way when we had it. So, again, research-based information is always more valuable than basic conjecture. Conjecture may work sometimes, but the research is what really gives us the proof in the pudding, so to speak. So we're going to take a break here. When we come back, I'd like to finish up talking about really two other real important topics that you have listed here. The search methods that isolate the firefighter and the victim, because we've seen, unfortunately, too many stories, close calls with that happening. And also the incident command size up and decision making. So we'll take a break, folks. We'll be right back right after these words with our guests, PJ and Sean, right after these words. Please stay tuned. You're listening to 5-Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. Ho, ho, ho! It's that holiday time again when many of us are trying to stretch every dollar to both purchase gifts for those we love and contribute what we can to the needy. This year, why not accomplish both by visiting the 5-Alarm Task Force storefront with our friends from Teespring? Just head over to our site at http://bit.ly/DalmatStore with a capital D, capital S, all one word, and choose from our several t-shirts, each with a different message on the back, or one of our emblazoned mugs. Both items come in multiple colors. The good folks at Teespring will wrap them all up and send it to the address of your choice. Once you've ordered your merchandise, you can be comforted by the thought that a portion of the net proceeds of all the merchandise sold is donated to the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. This wonderful organization helps the families of those firefighters who have made the ultimate sacrifice. What a great way to spread some holiday joy for them. So purchase some sharp 5-Alarm Task Force gifts and help a very special charity as well. From all of us at 5-Alarm Task Force, have a safe and joyous holiday season.
Psst. Yeah, you, it's me, your heart. Listen to me. We've got to talk. High blood pressure is serious, and yours? Whoa. What happened to us? We used to be so much more active. But lately, you've been ignoring me. I know you think I'm just gonna keep ticking away forever, but you're wrong. You can do so much more to control your high blood pressure. Doing the minimum isn't doing enough. I'm under a lot of pressure and can quit whenever I want. Bet you didn't know that. But I like my job. Just treat me better. Check on me. Give me something green to nibble on every once in a while. And maybe we can do some exercise on occasion. Let's get to it. After all, we're in this together.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to this special episode of 5-Alarm Task Force. News and issues for today's first responders. I'm your host, Steve Green. And with me are my very special and accommodating guests, Chief PJ Norwood and Captain Sean Gray, authors of The Evolving Fireground. And we're talking about some great subjects, important areas of thinking. And a lot of it is based, as their book is, on research. But some people say, well, what kind of research? Who did the research? Was there a hidden agenda for doing this research? So, Sean, let's start with you. Why don't you explain to the listeners what kind of fire research you guys especially are talking about and what we should be listening to?
Yeah, so, one of my jobs, I guess, as a UL advisory board member, is to kind of try to connect the dots with the fire service. So with the UL and Firefighter Safety Research Institute, we have an advisory board, and it's 25 people from all over the country, from myself working for Cobb County, Georgia, to Deputy Chief of Operations, like in Los Angeles County. We have Seattle Fire Department, Chicago, New York, and, you know, just this whole group of people, even all the way to Tokyo, Japan, and wow, firefighters from Sweden. So what we really discuss in those yearly meetings is, what's the future of the research? What does the fire service want to know? And so in those meetings, we discuss this, what's next? What's the next research study? But a lot of people think that UL is trying to make money, but I can tell you that couldn't be further from the truth. I recently had a guy on it that works with me actually said, hey, if you don't mind me asking, man, how much does UL pay you? I'm like, pay me? What are you talking about? They don't pay me anything. And all that time and energy that you spend with them and traveling and this and that, I'm like, dude, they don't pay me a dime. I don't make any money from the Underwriters Laboratories. So, and that blew his mind, because everybody, there's this social media machine that makes it look like UL is trying to make millions of dollars to sell books. UL FSRI is a nonprofit, and everything is run off of dollars that are funded by federal grants, by FEMA grants.
Right.
And that's where they come from. So they don't get grants every year because they, you know, they put in for them, and sometimes they get denied, sometimes they get accepted. But that is where the research studies come from. And those research studies are based off of questions that the U.S. Fire Service has been asking. Fire attack, for example. What's the difference between interior and exterior streams? And how do those streams affect the fire dynamics, the fire environment, and what are they doing to the possible victims inside? And so, you know, the next upcoming study that we're going to have is on search. And search and rescue is what the way that we remove victims. What's the best and most efficient way to remove victims? I can tell you from my own experiences, we were taught in recruit school to grab somebody and pick them up, right? Well, if you've ever actually picked up somebody that's unconscious and grab them from behind and try to get your arms underneath theirs, and they just fall out of you like a piece of spaghetti.
Right.
And so it doesn't work that great, right? And then if you try to get them up higher, you're now up in the flow path and up in the smoke. So is that the best way that we want to have somebody that is maybe breathing, barely breathing, you know, you're exposing them to the environment. So looking at ways, keeping them behind closed doors and that kind of stuff. So really the research is based off of the UL advisory board. I can tell you there's no agendas. It's absolutely, that's why all of the technical panels that are there. So every study has a 25-member technical panel. Those are technical panels from firefighters all over the nation. They take applications. They usually get about 200 applicants for 25 spots. And they are from a two-station department that's career to all volunteer to an FDNY that has 200 stations. So they completely vary, and they come from varying backgrounds, and they try to take a whole as the fire service to everybody has an option to speak up and try to put in their time and effort into the study. And so, you know, it's really, I think that they are fair and balanced. And to say that there's an agenda, I can promise you that there's not. The agenda is to make us better. So if that's an agenda, then I guess there is.
That's good. That's good. PJ?
Yeah, you know, I could back that up, because, you know, I applied by chance to the exterior fire and attic fire technical panel, really not knowing what to expect, but went to Northbrook, Illinois with an open mind, and Sean and I entered this conference room, and we sat around this huge table with, you know, officers, like Sean said, from FDNY, from Chicago, from Los Angeles, you know, and I felt a little bit out of place, and especially not knowing what to expect. You know, Steve Kerber came in, Dan Majakowski came in, and all the players from UL and all the technical panel members. We sat around this table, and I had my notepad out, expecting Steve to say, okay, this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it. And Steve opened up the meeting by introducing himself, the UL staff, and says, okay, what do you want to know about exterior fires, and what do you want to know about attic fires? And I'm insane to myself, well, no, that's why we're here, for you to tell us what we want to know and what we're going to find out through research. And we spent the entire day going around that table discussing incidents that we had and questions that we had as far as exterior fire spread, and attic fires. And the fire protection engineers in the room were taking lots of notes and putting things together. And then they said, okay, well, you guys want to know this. So in order to find out these answers, these are some of the things that we could do to achieve those answers, to find these answers out. Is that what you want to do? Well, yeah, that sounds great, but let's change A and B. Okay, so we change A and B. So UL gave us the platform, the fire service, to tell them what we wanted to know, and then they figured out how to study it. So it's complete opposite of what many people think. UL drives the technical panels based right. on the information that the technical panel provides on what they want to know based on what the fire service wants to know. And it was an extremely rewarding and enlightening experience, I know for me, to really look at the fire service as a whole. You know, problems and things that I see in Connecticut are very, very different than problems and things that they see in Los Angeles County versus down where you are, down in Florida currently, which are very different from what you saw in Massachusetts.
Right.
So to sit around the room and listen to everybody's different problems regarding exterior fires and attic fires, and then having UL say, okay, well, in order to answer all these questions, this is what we could do. Then seeing them build the props, put the research together, and going and watching these experiments firsthand, not from the YouTube channel, and really see the passion that's put into it from the firefighters, the fire protection engineers, Steve Kerber, Dan Majakowski, the advisory panel, the ULFRSI advisory panel, was extremely, extremely enlightening and motivating for me, because the passion of these people is incredible.
That's great. That's great to hear, and it's a great clarification, and it has to put aside all the doubts that people have about the UL research. And, you know, both of you have, I think you really made it perfectly clear exactly how it comes about, and the best part is that it actually comes from the firefighters, and that's the most important thing.
I think, Steve, that's one of the most important things that I just want to touch on, is to emphasize that you may have seen me get fired up on social media recently calling out some technical panel members who were blaming UL for the tactical considerations that were produced. I can tell you that at the end of the day, when the research results come in, the tactical considerations are written and gone over in multiple meetings, emails, everything else by all of the technical panel members. They all have the opportunity to see every one of those tactical considerations. And so to blame UL for publishing something that they think is incorrect, or in their opinion is incorrect, is absolutely false. They had all the chance in the world to fix that as a technical panel member. So it's really the firefighters that are on that drive those tactical considerations.
Okay, that's really good to know. And I hope that our listeners will take that to heart and understand that. Before we just go to the next topic, you both said the words Los Angeles, and we want to make sure that all our listeners know that we're recording this on Friday evening, the 16th of November, and California is still in a terrible state of affairs as far as fires are concerned. New numbers came out from the northern part of the state of numbers missing. So even though we're talking here, talking business, Los Angeles and Northern California, Butte County, you're in our hearts, you're in our minds, you're in our prayers. We're thinking about you, and we hope you have the very best very soon. Okay, what I'd like to go over next, because it's such a, so unfortunately, it's all too often we see it in stories, is search methods that isolate the firefighter and the victim, because they can isolate us either way, correct? We could be isolated so that we're protected away from the fire, and we might choose a path that might not be the best, and we're isolated, and it's going to be difficult for others to come and rescue us. PJ, you yep. want to try to take that one to start?
So I think we should do it this one. Is I'd like to give Sean an opportunity to talk about the search stuff.
Okay.
And then I want to come in at the end of his and talk about a UL initiative that's I'm very dear to my heart that is helping drive some of our search techniques. I think they couple well together. But the search techniques that Sean and I discussed through research came from an incident that Sean experienced in Cobb County. So I think it's important for him to discuss that, and then I can come in and talk about the Close Before You Doze campaign.
Sounds good. Okay. Sean, if you will.
All right. So where a lot of this search stuff came from was I was an engineer at the time and driving a ladder truck the night of this civilian rescue that occurred. And, you know, what's important to know is that we are always there to search every single building, and that on this particular fire, we were not notified of any entrapments. As a matter of fact, as we pulled in the subdivision of this townhome, there was somebody in the roadway waving us down saying, "Hey, my house is on fire at the end of the street." You would have thought that that person who just escaped from that burning house would have told us that his dad was still inside, but he did not. Right. So really, when we pulled up on the scene, there was all the indications of that nobody is in there. That guy has escaped on his own. He told us his house is on fire. There's been no mentions on dispatch or anything like that. But because we operate engine and truck, that we went in to search that night. And because it was 2 a.m, we felt that it was important to get to those rooms above, because that's where we know there's occupancy areas and the places where people are possibly trapped.
Sure.
So we hit the stairwell. We went right past the kitchen fire. Fire attack was coming up behind us. And when we got to that stairwell, we found an unconscious male in the stairwell. All of us were caught off guard, because I think subconsciously we were thinking we weren't going to find anybody. Because so for many years we had searched and not found anybody. And then suddenly we found this guy when we weren't really expecting to find somebody. So we should always expect to find victims. And then what we learned was trying to remove him turned out to be a lot more difficult than what we had trained. And so we took that experience. We got him out, successful rescue. Everything went great. We revived him on the scene. Our advanced life support units revived him. He was actually awake and talking by the time that he left the scene, I should say. He was discharged from the hospital the next day. But we learned a lot of lessons there, and those lessons refined into an article that I wrote for Fire Engineering Magazine, and it's called Lessons Learned from a Civilian Rescue. And we wanted to be better. We decided that we weren't prepared to find a victim. Myself and the other firefighters that were on the rig that night decided that we hadn't really talked about, hey, what if we come across a victim? What are we going to do? How are we going to drag them? What are some indications? Maybe we should close the door. Maybe we should keep them behind the closed door,
right,
and then take them out a window or take them out a ladder. There's all these different options. And so, man, we really dug in. There's a group of about 15 to 20 of us that got together and started teaching search for our department, and at a truck academy that we were hosting. It got very passionate about it. And I can tell you, hours upon hours upon hours of discussions, long nights in the bars, arguing, discussing things, and really working it out and coming up with a good plan. And that's ultimately what we came up with, was you got to have a search plan. And that's where we developed a lot of our search techniques that we currently teach for our FDIC hot class, that we've written about in our articles. And then it turns out that some of the research that has started to come out from our search techniques in the cardiac and cancer study, we had a situation where there's firefighters from Cobb County that know these search techniques, and they isolated the victim, or I should say a victim was found behind a closed door. And when that victim was, rather than taking that victim and dragging them back out the front door through the flow path, they actually just took the victim and dumped him out the window.
Right.
And never exposed them to anything. And when we came out from that, I was part of that group, and Steve Kerber accused us of cheating. He said, "Hey, so you guys planned that ahead of time, right?" We're like, "What do you mean? You knew the victim was in there. Somebody gave you a heads up." And no, we didn't know that anybody was in there, and we didn't plan on taking that person out of there. And he said, "Well, why did you guys do that? Nobody else has done that. Out of 30 other crews that we put through here, nobody else has left the door closed and took them out the window." And I was like, "Well, that's something that we've trained on and kind of changed our search techniques to think about closing the door and talking about exposing people to carcinogens and all that stuff. And talking about flow path, we make everything better for the flow path, not taking people into flow paths." And so that's kind of where a lot of our search techniques were developed. And then that goes into PJ and the whole close before you do stuff.
Wow. That's amazing. I can think back to the several searches that I was on, and you're right. We were looking for a victim, but we had no idea what we were going to do with a victim if we found them, except getting them out. How? We never talked about that in advance. It was just, you'd have to play it by the seat of your pants if you found them.
That's right.
So,
yeah,
I'm sure there are thousands of us who never thought of it that way at all. So that's really good information. And again, something that hopefully that our listeners can learn and take to heart, take to their department, to their office, line officers, to the chiefs, and say, listen, you know, we heard this on a podcast. It's in this book. We can get this book. Let's look at it and see what it has to say. PJ, this new program about keeping the doors closed that so many of us are promoting now. In fact, I've done it with my family and my girls who are off in their own places now, but I've told them when they sleep at night, they got to have those doors closed.
Yeah, thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss this. This is a great program, and it comes about from there's four or five of us on the UL's Public Education Advisory Group. And it started a couple years ago where we met Steve Kerber 5 o'clock in the morning in Indianapolis. And we said, look, there's all this research and data about, you know, isolating ourselves when we go in and do search in buildings and all this information of how bad the smoke is, how toxic the smoke is. And we think that there's a piece that's missing. And the piece that was missing was the public education piece. So we started looking at if we're isolating ourselves when we search, because we know that it protects us and it protects the potential victim, we should probably look at, well, what happens if we get people to sleep with their doors closed? And we started looking at the research from a different perspective and a different angle. And that we found that, man, if we can get everybody to sleep with their doors closed, they're going to increase their chance of survival because we're keeping them out of that environment for that much longer until they can either escape on their own or until we can get there. So the close before your doze message is extremely, extremely important for all of us to be discussing during our fire prevention and education talks. It's important for us to be discussing with our family because we will save lives. I have a prediction, and it's a personal opinion, that in the fire service, we are going to save more civilians in the next 5 years because of this endeavor of a close before you doze than ever before. But here's the caveat to that. We have to be ready. We have to be ready to search. We have to be proficient at event, enter, isolate, search. We have to be ready to get into these survivable spaces because now we're telling our civilians, we're telling our family to close the door before you go to bed at night, and you're going to be sleeping in an area that's going to give you a greater chance of survival. But now that they're in these spots, they may not be able to self-rescue. So we really have to change our mindset of that every fire that we go to, there's survivable space, but we have to be proficient to get in there quickly and efficiently to make those grabs and to make those saves. So while the Close Before You Doze campaign is a public safety education message, it also impacts us, the fire service, because we really have to put a focus on good quality searches and being ready to get into these survivable spaces. So the last bit on this, I could get on a tangent, is the Close Before You Doze is an important piece for us, but there's valuable information for all of us on the website, closeyourdoor.org. There's information there as far as public information for you to provide on your social media outlets. There's videos, there's downloadable materials, everything that you need, all the way down to media press releases on a Close Before You Doze campaign in your community are all available for free on closebeforeyoudoze.org or closeyourdoor.org. I'm sorry.
That's great, because I'll go there to see if they have an audio PSA that I can run in our spots, in the rotation of our spots on every podcast.
We do. There are PSAs there that are driven for the adults, but also for children.
Wonderful. Another point I want to bring up to the door thing is we're coming up on almost another couple of weeks will be the anniversary of the terrible fire in New York City where the mother, she had gone out and left the young kids there in the lower apartment, which was right facing an upper stairwell. And she came home, the apartment was on fire, and she ran out and she left the door open rather than closing it. And of course, the result tragically was that fire went right up that stairwell, and we lost eight other lives that day. Is part of the push to tell people that if they do run out of a house that's on fire, to make sure they close that door behind them?
Correct, Steve. So there's pieces to the Close Before You Doze campaign that involves our law enforcement partners, our fire service dispatch partners, the public, to teach them to while also sleeping with your door closed, if you're a 911 operator, before you have that disconnect, if somebody tells you, and you tell somebody if you can safely exit your house, exit, but close your door behind you when you leave. Right? So it's an important piece for our public safety dispatchers.
Good.
Our police officers, right? Our police officers are traditionally will always arrive at a lot of our building fires first because they're out there. They're on the road. So teaching them to close that door if that front door of that house is open. Or we're not going to tell – we could tell police officers all day long to not go into a building that's on fire. But we know police officers, they're public safety professionals. If they pull up at a house at 2 o'clock in the morning, they're going to do everything that they can to try to get inside to make sure that there's nobody in there.
Absolutely.
So teaching the police officers the valuable piece of keeping those doors closed, or if you are going to go into that building to try to get somebody out, close the door behind you before you leave and don't break windows. And so there's many pieces of the Close Before You Doze campaign that does involve educating the public, but also our public safety dispatchers and our police officers.
Well, that's wonderful. And we'll make sure we'll add that on the posting on our guest page for you and Sean. Gentlemen, I just can't thank you enough for your time tonight. I know, PJ, you're driving onto something on your own. Sean, you're at home. First of all, I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank you for your dedication to the cause that we all love, whether we're active, whether we're retired, whether we're disabled out. It's still in our blood. It's who we are. It's what we do. And we love to, at least I'll speak it, that I love to meet more and more firefighters who are still doing the job or have done the job, but have the same dedication that I felt I had, and I've tried to keep in my heart ever since I've been out. And for you guys to take this time on a Friday evening, I really can't thank you enough for everything you do, and also to educate our brothers and sisters, because that's one of your big pushes, is not just being the officers in your departments. You've shown this evening you do everything you can to learn more and then help educate our brothers and sisters who can't all participate in these studies and all these conferences. And that's one of the things that I'm dedicated to with this podcast, is get information out to people who can't necessarily go to a conference like FDIC or even the Great Florida Fire School we had, but let them hear some of the people who were the instructors there and let them learn from them and then take it back. Take it to heart, as I said before, and take it back to their people and share it with them and say, listen, you can learn more if you reach out to these people. And I think that's what, as we said before we even started, that's what this is all about, is trying to teach more to the fire service to do our job better, not more professionally, because we're all professionals. That's the most important thing. Whether you're career, part paid, or volunteer, we're all professionals when we do this job, and we're all dedicated to the 1,000%. But we want to do the job to the best of our ability, learn as much as we can to do it safely, to protect our citizens and to protect ourselves. Because if we don't protect ourselves first, we can't rescue any citizens. So we have to take care of ourselves first. So PJ and Sean, thank you so very much. I wish you and your families a very safe, enjoyable Thanksgiving and holiday season to all, both of you, very much. It was a great show. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, Steve, thank you. And thank you for what you do for helping educate firefighters. That's what Sean and I are about. So we appreciate what you do and for giving us an opportunity to speak with you and your listeners tonight. So thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure. And I'm happy to do it. And we look forward to many more. Hopefully we'll have you guys back in several months with some more information. Again, we thank
you. That'd be great. Thanks for having us on.
My pleasure. Folks, we want to thank PJ Norwood and Sean Gray for their time this evening. We'll be right back right after these words. Please don't go away. That SCBA is really a pain, right? Strap it on, then the mask. Jeez, plenty of guys used to fight fire without them. Why can't I? Well, meet my little friends. Arsenic, asbestos, benzene, benzopyrene, diesel exhaust, formaldehyde, polychlorinated biphenyls, polychlorinated dibenzopidioxins, vinyl chloride, 1,3 butadiene, and chronic hepatitis B and C virus. That's right. When you don't wear your full PPE, including your SCBA, you're inviting these little buggers into your innermost parts. They bring multiple cancers, including kidney, liver, prostate, testicular, and lung, plus multiple myeloma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, leukemia, and much more.
And if you don't decon, where you go, they go. Hey, honey, better set the table. I'm bringing some friends home for dinner with you and the kids. Smarten up. Wear your full PPE and SCBA for you and for them.
So five tacos of cheese and a large soda, that's $10,012. Please drive around.
Wait, 10,000 what?
It's obvious you're buzzed and driving.
I've only had a few. I'm fine.
Yeah, the food's $12, but getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Please drive around. Actually, just park and come in.
Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Steve. Have you ever wanted to ask a question or two to a panel of chiefs or officers to get an outside opinion from your own department? Well, you'll be able to do that on our special podcast, The Panel Program. We have several chiefs who have volunteered to be part of a panel where I will give them the questions that you've sent in to me at dalmatprod@outlook.com or through Twitter at dalmatprod or via Instagram at dalmatians_productions. And I'll present those questions to the chiefs, and they'll answer them on that podcast. We'll record it, of course, and then we'll tell you the date when it'll be available. But to do that, we need to have enough questions to make it worthwhile. So please, send those questions in. The best way is email dalmatprod@outlook.com, and we'll let you know when the panel is scheduled. And then once it's all edited, we'll let you know when it's going to be broadcast. So tune in to 5 Alarm Task Force and send in your questions to dalmatprod@outlook.com. Thanks for listening. Remember, stay safe, and let's make sure everyone goes home. Hi, this is Steve Green. Hope you enjoyed this podcast with our guests, Chief P.J. Norwood and Captain Sean Gray, about the evolving fireground. I hope you learned a lot from it. You'll take it to heart and take it home and bring it to your department as well. This is our last podcast that will be broadcast prior to Thanksgiving. And I want to take a moment to thank all of you for the great year that you gave us. We really grew in 2018. Our podcast is now heard in over 60 countries, and that's amazing to us, to know that we have firefighters, firefighter families, or buffs who like the fire service listening to our podcasts from all around the world. Gives us a great feeling here. But most importantly, we want to know that we're bringing great information to the fire service and other first responders as well. While sometimes we have some entertaining moments, most of our podcasts deal with real issues that are faced by our brothers and sisters in the fire service, EMS, and even law enforcement and recovery. And that's what's important to us. We want to bring you great information that you can use. So, on behalf of my family and I, because without them I wouldn't be able to do this, I want to thank you for tuning in and listening to 5 Alarm Task Force. Whether you listen to every single podcast or you tune in once in a while, we're very thankful. So to you and your family, if you're in the United States, if you're Americans that are outside of the United States, we wish all of you a very happy and safe Thanksgiving. To everyone else, thank you again for listening, and we'll be back with a new show next week. Thanks for listening, 5 Alarm Task Force. Stay safe and stay well. And let's make sure everyone goes home.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
And that wraps this special episode of 5 Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. We would like to thank our guests, Deputy Chief P.J. Norwood and Captain Sean Gray, for joining us to discuss the evolving fireground. Did you know you can now find us and subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and most podcast streaming services? Just search for 5 Alarm Task Force. We also want to thank our sponsor, Insight Training LLC, your best bet for fire service thermal imaging training.
and their promotional partners, Dalmatian Productions, The Firehouse Tribune, Chief Miller Products and Sites, Hennessy Distributing, your source for the cool towel, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, and the 2018 Great Florida Fire School. If you would like to be a guest with us or have a suggestion for a show, please drop us a line to dalmatprod@outlook.com. We want to know that we're bringing you the topics that you are interested in. You can follow us on Twitter at dalmatprod or at cause_origin, and on Facebook at /dalmatprod or /dalmatprodfire, and stay up to date with all the news about our podcast, Dalmatian Productions, and our blog on our website, www.dalmatianproductions.tv. I'm Steve Green. Until next time, stay safe, and let's make sure everyone goes home.